Warren, Vermont, at 05674. Any amount is greatly appreciated. We just love to know that you care about the station and you want us to stay on the air. And we haven't had a fundraiser in 4 years, so we haven't really asked you guys for any money since then. Another way you can support the station, I actually have an underwriter for the 4-H show today, is Mountainside Ski Service. Ski rentals, demos, tuning, and custom boot fitting since 1995, or your full-service ski shop for personal attention since 1995. Oops. Oh, well, I hope I don't get in too much trouble for that one. Anyway, you can reach Mountainside Ski Service at 802-583-9299 or online at mountainsideski.com. And they're located in the Sugar Bush Village across the Chez Henri Bridge and just past the daycare on the left. And like I started to say, if you want to support the station by becoming an underwriter, if you own a business, or maybe you have a pet who wants to underwrite us, you can do that, and you can find that information online, or you can give us a call, 802-496-4951. And I want to thank you all for listening, and I do want to talk about my guests that are calling in today in about 5 minutes. And there are three people that we're going to chat with this afternoon. One is Michael Koss. He is a Dartmouth College alumni. He received his MBA from New York University Langone Health Program, and he is going to talk about vaccine mandates for colleges. And there's still, I think, over 200 colleges that are requiring mandates for the upcoming school season. And he'll be joined by Dr. Joel Walskog. Dr. Walskog is an MD and a surgeon, and he co-founded an organization called React 19. And that is an organization focused on people who have suffered from vaccine injuries. And my third very special guest is Joni Ruller McGarry, and she is the co-founder of she's one of NoCollegeMandates.com. She's also a mother of a student who's currently attending Dartmouth College. And what we're going to be discussing is college vaccine mandates, vaccine injuries, and there's an upcoming event being held at Dartmouth College on April 26th, which is being sponsored by React 19. And it's an event that, especially if you are a college student, if you have students in college now or getting ready to go, you might want to really check this out. It's going to be a roundtable discussion about the ethics and purpose of mandatory college vaccinations. And I was just reading a study until Joni and Michael and Joel call in. And this was a study that was just completed March 30th, and it's in the British Medical Journal, which is one of the most highly regarded medical journals in the world. And it's in their Journal of Medical Ethics, and it's called COVID-19 Vaccine Boosters for Young Adults, a Risk-Benefit Assessment and Ethical Analysis of Mandate Policies at Universities. And it's really fascinating what they've come up with. For colleges to be mandating boosters, just after looking at the study that's been done, and this, of course, isn't the only study. There's several that have been done that I know Joni and Michael and Joel have talked about and probably will talk about. But the information in this study just proves that there is absolutely no reason to mandate boosters. They're not effective at stopping COVID. I think most people that are listening, if you've been vaccinated, you've probably had COVID. At least my empirical data, everyone I know who's vaccinated that I can think of almost has had COVID. Would they have been sicker without the vaccination? That's an interesting question. I don't know how we know that, but originally we were told that you would not get COVID. And COVID, the vaccinations do not stop transmission. So that fact alone, and that is a fact that is admitted by the CDC, by the WHO, by the FDA, it does not stop transmission. So what's the purpose of a mandate makes no sense, because to tell someone they have to get vaccinated would only be to protect other people. I mean, you do have the right to decline a medical procedure if it's only affecting you. And what they're basically saying is, well, I guess you don't have that right, because we know it doesn't stop transmission, but we want you to get vaccinated anyway. It's just, it's a little crazy. Anyway, Joni and Michael and Joel will be talking about this event that's coming up at Dartmouth. It's at the Hanover Inn. And they have a panel of people, and they'll probably tell you more about it because I think that's them. WMRW.
Hi, is this Jerry?
Yeah, hi Joni. Are you ready to go on the air?
Yeah, I'm gonna bring in Michael and Joel right now.
Okay. We're getting everybody on the air now.
Okay, so
Joel
and Michael are here. We're all here, Jerry.
Great, okay. I'm gonna put you on the air. Hang up. Okay, Joni, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Great. I can hear you too. So that works well. Thank you so much for doing the show. I'm really excited about having all of three of you on. And I'll just do an intro again. I did it a few minutes ago, but just to let everybody know who I'm talking to. This is Joni Roll McGarry. She's the co-founder of NoCollegeMandates.com. She's the mother of a student currently attending Dartmouth College. And she's being joined by Michael Koss. He is a Dartmouth College alumni who received his MBA from NYU Langone Health Program. And Dr. Joel, will I just get your Walskog? He's an MD and a surgeon who is the co-founder of React 19. So thank you all for being here. I'm really excited that you're here. And I guess I'd like to start with maybe you, Joni, or all three of you. How did you first get involved with this issue of vaccine mandates?
I'll say briefly that it came to my radar when my son was going back for his winter term, I think it was junior year at Dartmouth, and he was mandated, he had to get a booster in order to stay enrolled. And he had just complied with the primary series booster a mere 8 months prior to that. So it really raised a signal to me that there wasn't something, there was not, these boosters were not needed. If the primary series didn't work, why did he need the second? And I was concerned that a booster mandate in a young person was just a bridge too far. So I became very interested in working to restore medical choice for students on campus, particularly for this, for this shot. And ended up organizing parents and stakeholders, not just at Dartmouth, but across colleges across the country, because at that time, about 1,000 colleges were mandating, and about 300 had started to mandate boosters. And that landscape remains similar today, although some schools are starting to drop now. There still remain many hundreds of colleges that are still mandating this product for their students as a condition of enrollment. That's my short story.
Do you have any idea why these booster mandates are being mandated? Why they're doing this? Have you in your come up with it? When you ask them, do they give you an answer?
Just to give you a little history, I think that when colleges first started mandating, to be fair, everyone was scrambling to provide the most safe environment on campus for not only the students, but for the faculty and the community at large. And people, you know, we didn't know then, especially when the vaccines came out, we weren't aware, we weren't told that the products couldn't prevent infection or transmission. So, you know, after everyone had shut down for safety, when the vaccines came along, campuses saw a way to reopen safely. And so they made this a requirement of all community members based on public health recommendations and public health messaging that if you get the shot, you won't get the virus, and then my shot will protect you, my shot protects me. If everybody gets it, you know, we're good. Yeah. And at that time, you know, the CDC, Pfizer, Moderna, they knew that the products didn't stop transmission because these products were never trialed for that. But the information that the colleges were getting, you know, that was what they believed. And so they put the mandates in place. Soon after that, it became very clear because of campus outbreaks because kids were still having to get tested weekly, twice weekly. There was compulsory masking. It was very clear that the mandates had not stopped transmission on campus, even though the compliance rate for vaccination on most campuses, even those, on most mandating campuses, it was 95-98%, right? And, and yet, there was still campus outbreaks. So I think they saw the booster as a way to, go at it again, even though it didn't make any sense that if the first round didn't prevent infection, the second round wasn't going to give you any protection either. So I think it was just that mindset and the lack of colleges doing their own very rigorous risk-benefit analysis with these products upon this population.
Yeah, yeah. Michael, can you chime in here and tell us why you got involved?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having us on your show. And I'd also like to just say hello to everybody in the area. My family has had a place in Sugarbush and Waitsfield for, I think, over 50, 60 years now. So,
oh, really?
I'm very familiar with the area. I love it. I used to spend my summers there as a kid growing up, and our winters, we were weekend warriors coming up to Sugarbush. So anyway, I just wanted to say that and thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
My journey has been different. I work on Wall Street. I try to pay attention to shifting trends, and obviously everything related to COVID was having a very large impact on everybody, and it wasn't totally clear, at least initially, how severe it would be, and who it would affect the most and what could be done about it. I think fairly quickly, at least from my estimation, we were able to understand that it was having a larger impact for elderly people, and thankfully younger people, healthier, with a lack of comorbidities, were not ending up in the hospitals, and not severely affected. There were also early signals that things like vitamin D could be very helpful in that regard. Obesity was a very large factor. And so, it didn't take that long for me, at least, to realize that these injections, which were certainly experimental, had not had long-term history of testing on humans. There was a real risk there, and we didn't fully understand what that risk would be, but relative to the risk of not taking the vaccine, particularly for younger people, I thought it was more of a gamble at that point.
Yeah.
And when the vaccine started to come out, to Joni's point, we also started to see that there were, what they called breakthrough infections, and those were more and more common. So it became pretty evident just observationally that it was not stopping transmission. We later learned that based on where the virus is sort of held in the larynx and how it's ultimately transmitted, that the vaccine didn't stop transmission in that regard, and it was more than thought of as a way of keeping you from getting severely ill or hospitalized or dying of the disease. And once we knew that, to me, became a much more personal decision for the person who was deciding whether they wanted to take this experimental injection. And mandates made no sense at that point, for sure. We could debate whether they ever did, but certainly at a certain point, and it was quite a long time ago, I think the data was fairly clear about that. So, because of that, and I have children, and I certainly don't want to see other children be injured by these vaccines. I started spending more time with my local superintendent and
hello,
seeing some of the data, and hi, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're breaking up a little, but go ahead, and we'll see if it continues.
Yeah, and I'm sorry because I'm in a car, and if I do break out, I'll probably just have to let Billy and Joel take it from here. But I started the position of 22. In August of 22, I thought it was time for these mandates to be taken away at the university collegiate level. And so I reached out and I expressed my strong concern about everything that I just talked about in an email to the college. And there was some back and forth, but ultimately I never felt like my message was getting through. And as you know, and part of that was just really simply, if it was getting through, they would have dropped the mandates already. And so the fact that they've continued, you know, even to this day, was the real impetus for writing an open letter to the college community, which you can find at openlettertodartmouth.com, and getting in touch with other alumni to see what we could do about it. And ultimately, we decided to bring this roundtable discussion to the school's doorstep in the hopes of having a more open dialogue about these issues.
Yeah, I guess they never gave you any real legitimate or even legal reason for why they were imposing these mandates, apparently. Is that correct?
They did respond, and there was some back and forth. Responded with a legal rationale. You know, they did say that they still believe that these help reduce community spread and help keep people out of hospitals, and ultimately they're safe and effective. And they also continue to mention the fact that they allow for religious and medical exemptions. And I think that was sort of their backdoor way of saying, look, we're not really coercing students. If there's a medical or religious reason for not taking it, you can apply, and you know, we're likely to accept that that rationale. You know, in my own experience, I don't believe that a medical exemption is really attainable. At least it wasn't then. There were very few doctors who were even talking about the potential harm, much less willing to stake their, you know, their potential medical license on providing these medical exemptions. And so I never viewed that as a realistic way of abstaining from these mandates. And so that's why I continue to push to this day as hard as I do, because I don't believe it's really attainable. And it's really unnecessary. Somebody shouldn't have to opt out. They can opt in if they'd like. So, you know, to more directly answer your original question, there was some back and forth. Those were the rationale. They definitely cited the CDC multiple times, which to me, again, was clear evidence that they were not appreciating a lot of the issues that were also going on at the CDC and the FDA and with the manufacturers, and some of the disincentives or you know, lack of what's the right word? There were conflicts of interest. That's what,
yeah.
Right. And so understanding that and having some appreciation for those conflicts of interest made me realize that they're really relying on the wrong people. And when the CDC ultimately downgraded their view on COVID and effectively said, you know, we're not going to distinguish going forward between vaccinated and unvaccinated, that was an opportunity for me to go back to the college and say, you're really on your own now. You know, whereas everybody was really relying on the CDC as cover for these sorts of mandates, that cover is gone now, and you better have a very good reason for continuing with these mandates.
Yeah, it even more begs the question, what's the point? Especially, but Dr. Walsgood, would you like to chime in here and tell us how you got involved?
Yes, thank you very much. So I'm a orthopedic surgeon. I'm a medical doctor. I'm licensed in the state of Wisconsin as well as the state of Texas. I received my one and only Moderna shot on December 30th of 2020. 7 days later, I had difficulty walking. I began falling. I have numbness and problems with my legs, and I subsequently was diagnosed with a condition called transverse myelitis. Transverse myelitis, for me, involves an injury to my spinal cord. So if you remember back into the AstraZeneca trial in the United Kingdom, the AstraZeneca trial was delayed twice for three cases of transverse myelitis. So since my spinal cord injury after my Moderna shot, I've unfortunately been unable to return to work as an orthopedic surgeon. I'm now totally disabled. I am co-chair of an organization. It's an advocacy organization called React 19. It's react19.org, and we are an advocacy organization where we represent over 21,000 Americans that are injured by the COVID shots. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. We are science-based, grassroots. We're a non-political organization, although we admit we're certainly in a highly politicized environment. So that's how I, you know, became really involved in this whole issue. You know, as a physician, you know, I believe in science. And really, I want to be very clear that I am absolutely against these college mandates. These college mandates need to end now. And the reason for that is the science. And I urge young people, I urge parents of children to really look at the data themselves. We can't necessarily believe, always trust, you know, our federal agencies to look out for us. We should be able to, but in this situation, people really need to do their homework and look at the data themselves and look at the risks and benefits. The one thing I want to say, there's no doubt about it, early on, you know, COVID, especially in the early Wuhan strains, there was significant morbidity and mortality with the, particularly the early Wuhan strains, but the risk to young people of COVID, especially with these later variants, is statistically zero. The risk of children dying from COVID, if you look at studies, it's somewhere between 3 and 9 per million die of COVID. I always tell people, put that in your calculator. If you divide 3 divided by 1 million, your calculator will tell you zero. So statistically, the rate of them dying is zero. The other thing is what is people's natural immunity to COVID? If you look on the CDC data, which I just looked yesterday, 96.3% of young people are seropositive, meaning they already have antibodies to COVID. Seropositivity means if they have antibodies, that would suggest they have some degree or they have natural immunity. So you're giving a shot to someone who really doesn't need it and has significant risks. Now, let's talk a little bit about myocarditis, because myocarditis is one of the significant risk factors of getting a COVID shot to young people. There's a couple of studies that look at the risk of myocarditis. And the risk is somewhere between 2 and 6%. That's alarming. I mean, there's a classic, it's called the TIE study, that shows the risk is 2%. Well, that's 2 per 100. That's alarming. So I really urge people to really delve into the risk, benefits, and options for young people or for parents of children, because really, in my opinion, the risks of the shots far outweigh any potential benefits. And I always say, if you go to your provider and they just use the coined term of, quote, safe and effective, end quote, run, because this issue is much more complicated than just a simple statement of safe and effective. These young people, unfortunately, just don't need the shot. They really put themselves at significant risk. They get little to no benefit. Most of them have natural immunity. And for all those reasons, to me, I would never, I have four children, I would never have my children get vaccinated for COVID. I think it's all risk and no benefit. And therefore, I think these college mandates should be stopped immediately.
Oh, gosh.
Can I just jump in really quick?
Yes.
Because some people don't really understand what myocarditis is and what the long-term implications might be. And we often hear that it is mild and transitory. And Joel, I was wondering if you could speak a little to the seriousness of that side effect.
Yeah, so myocarditis means inflammation of the heart. Young people who get myocarditis can often have permanent heart damage or die. If you look at Ernest Ramirez's 16-year-old son, 5 days after the shot, died of myocarditis and a heart attack. He was 16 years old. I can tell you story after story. Unfortunately, in my realm of, you know, being a co-chair of an advocacy organization, I'm exposed to numerous parents of dead children. These cases are real. So myocarditis really involves just inflammation of the heart, and again, it can get so serious even to cause permanent heart damage or death. So the risk is real, and you don't want your children to get that. Did I answer your question? I can't remember. There was.
Yeah, I think Joni was asking you to describe myocarditis, which you did.
Yeah, it's real, and for those, you know, those that get it, I mean, it can cause permanent heart damage, and it's tough because we have to really start asking more detailed questions about risk benefit analysis, and without really doing that, we're not giving people informed consent. And informed consent, and you know, the old principle of first do no harm in medicine is very important. And you know, these kids just don't need the shot.
Yeah.
It's just different. We have to evaluate, you know, and be more critical in how we're doing these risk benefit analyses, rather than just globally saying everyone needs all these shots continually. And remember, I mean, again, the shots were intended to prevent infection and transmission. That didn't work. We hoped it worked, but it didn't, unfortunately.
Can I just ask you, before you had one shot, and then 7 days later you said you suffered this spinal injury. Did you have any medical issues prior to the vaccination?
I have low testosterone, so I take a testosterone injection once a week. That is the only medicine I took. Now I take about 23 different medicines.
And before you were healthy and working and everything?
I was a 50-year-old orthopedist that worked about 70 hours per week. In the summer, I slalom water ski, I wakeboard, I wake surf, all of which I cannot do anymore. I was completely healthy.
So in your mind, especially being a physician, there's not much doubt that your condition was caused by the vaccination, correct? Is that...
There is no doubt in my mind that it was caused by the vaccination.
Gosh. I'm not sure who to direct this question to, but I'm just wondering, we have this emergency use authorization, and does that play into these college vaccine mandates at all, like the legitimacy of them?
Well, I can't answer that from a legal standpoint because I don't want to overstep, you know, I stay in my lane in terms of that. But I will say that because of the EUA, these products came on the market very quickly. And I think that colleges felt that they could mandate the products because of that. I don't think, you know, and they also were mandating tests approved under EUA as well, you know, the nasal swab, the mandatory testing that was done. All of those were under EUA. And then when the products were ostensibly FDA approved, and then they had a brand name associated with them, and this is a little off the topic of the question, and I think to this day this is true, if you go to get Comirnaty or Spikevax, which are the trade names for these quote approved products, you will not get that product. You will get the EUA product. It was a legal distinction so that the pharmaceutical companies could continue to enjoy financial indemnity from any harms done by the product.
Yeah, and that means if you are harmed, you cannot sue the pharmaceutical companies, right?
That is correct. If you're, it's because of that, and also because under the PREP Act, any COVID countermeasure is covered. So, you know, colleges, you know, ostensibly, and I don't know how the legal landscape will change, but at this point in time, everything they were doing in terms of COVID mitigation would be counted as a COVID countermeasure. So, you know, if you're a student and you get injured, or you suffer an adverse event or, God forbid, death from something, you know, and I think Joel can talk about this in terms of remedy for people who have been injured. You don't have a remedy at the college level. You know, you don't have this obvious remedy of that you will be cared for and taken care of.
Do you want to comment on that, Joel?
Yeah, I'd like to speak on that a little bit. If you are a young person and you get injured, or you are a parent and your child gets injured, you are completely on your own. You have no financial remedy. The only remedy you potentially can have is applying for financial remedy through what's called a CICP, which is a Countermeasures in Injury Compensation Program. Now, as of February 1st, of the 11,000 claims the Department of Health and Human Services have, they have approved only 19 claims and not paid out one. The denial rate for the CIC program is 96.5%. So I really want to reiterate to people that, you know, again, if you do have an unfortunate injury from one of the COVID shots, you're truly on your own. And I want to tell you a story of a young person. She was 18. Her name is Juliana Mastrantonio, because she's from, I believe, New York State. She is a very smart kid. She was a senior in high school. She had a history of some autoimmune disorders and did some of her own research and decided not to get the shot. She got a medical exemption. She then got into a college in New York State. I won't name the college, but she got into a college, got a large scholarship. But in order to go to the college, she had to get the shots, and her medical exemption was not recognized by the university that gave her the exemption. And guess what she developed? She developed transverse myelitis and ended up in a wheelchair.
Oh, no.
This is a real story. Her story is pretty public. So, you know, what is her remedy? Unfortunately, nothing.
Wow.
So these are real stories. And I can tell you story after story, because I've just been in this space and known a lot of parents of dead children, unfortunately. And, you know, I can tell you the story of Maddie DeGarry, who is pretty well known. You know, she was injured during the Pfizer trial. You know, how do they deal with her? If you look into the Pfizer trial, her data says that she had a functional neurological disorder, which means they called her crazy and had a stomach ache. But, you know, she's in a wheelchair and has a feeding tube. So, you know, these stories are real, and I don't mean to certainly scare people, but they really need to look into the data. I believe in science, and, you know, we get our direction from our federal agencies like the FDA, CDC, and NIH, but unfortunately, not all of their information is, in my opinion, science-based. There's a lot of what I would say is they have a lot of other motives.
Yeah, why aren't we hearing these stories in the news? Like the two stories you just told seem they're just.
I'd like to cover that.
And this is Michael, right?
Yeah, there's extreme censorship that's been going on through these last few years. It's really plain and simple. And as a keen observer of mainstream media, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, it was rampant. And it wasn't just the censorship, but it was also the scapegoating and the ostracism and the harshness that the establishment effectively took against anybody who was willing to speak up, even about actual injuries. And we're now getting more and more information that's coming out, some of which is coming out through the Twitter files that were released when Elon Musk purchased Twitter, where you see how the government organizations worked with the social media companies to not only hold back what they were deeming as misinformation, but it specifically says true information, right? They were withholding stories, true stories of people who would post on Twitter or on Facebook about their actual injuries from these vaccines, as if they never happened. And so, you know, there's countless stories. You might have heard about these, you know, people who were injured. They were featured, some of them, on different, you know, roundtable panels that I've seen. But the media didn't cover them. You had to go to rumble.com to even have a chance of watching these things. And, you know, most people don't spend their time actively looking for that sort of information. If they're not seeing it on the TV, if they're not hearing it on the news, it doesn't really exist. And when somebody even brings it up, or, you know, I'll give you an example. We'll have a panelist at the Dartmouth event, Martin Koldorf. He was one of the co-authors of the Great Barrington Declaration, and part of what they were focused on very early on, and it was signed on by many doctors all over the world, was to focus on the most vulnerable, which was really the elderly and the people who had more comorbidities, and not require, you know, that everybody be vaccinated and locked down. And we now see through emails that were released through FOIA requests of Dr. Fauci, Dr. Collins of the NIH and NAID that had conversations, you know, about these people, calling them fringe epidemiologists. And they were not only ignored, but they had a, it will, I think more information will come out, so I need to be careful, but it appears that there was a active campaign to you know, basically disregard these people. And so when you have that happening, it's not a surprise that most people don't know what's really transpired. We still don't know the true magnitude of the problem. And if you then take that back to the universities and the colleges who continue to get their information from the CDC and from the mainstream media, it's also no wonder that they continue to believe that these shots would indeed stop transmission and were not harmful and were safe and effective when they really weren't.
Yeah, I think that's still on the CDC website. Go ahead, Joni.
I was just going to jump in. You know, for somebody who could who listens to this and says, you know, oh, these injuries can't be real, or most people don't get them. Okay, you know, I disagree with that, but let's even just make another different kind of argument against mandates, even setting that aside, which is, you know, to me, one of the most compelling reasons not to mandate this product for young people is, you know, that it's a risk mandate. But even without that, the mandating of a medical intervention for young people who are a captive population is just an unethical thing to do, especially when this medical intervention is not needed by these students. And the college population is a uniquely captured population in that they're young people. You know, granted, they're full adults. However, they're often away from home for the first time. They're not in a community that, you know, they're new. Their surroundings are new. They don't have family nearby, and they are getting information by social media. They're getting information from their administrators and professors, and in this particular instance, it was all one way, right? I mean, the propagandization of these students, if that's a word, on campuses to get the vaccine, and it was a social imperative. You must get the vaccine to protect others. There was no counter dialogue that was allowed, and you know, the CDC gave out grants for social media people to, you know, basically pressure and coerce their peers on college campuses. The White House had a college campus vaccine challenge, and they encouraged colleges to sign up, and they encouraged such behavior as coaches and professors talking to students about how safe and effective these are and that they got their shot. You know, it basically putting themselves in a position of giving medical advice. The American College Health Association, which is, you know, sort of a nonprofit, you know, guider of health policy at the college level, and who, by the way, is largely funded by Pfizer. They took a grant from the CDC, and they translated some of that money into social media campaigns targeted at college students. So, you know, there really wasn't a robust discussion at the college level, and this is a highly compliant population. And then when people would say, well, you know, just stop out, just drop out, just don't go, leave that college. You know, let's just step back. Why should young people be punished by this? They've worked very hard to get into the college of their choice. Many had already said yes to a particular college with a particular set of scholarships and opportunities, and then said no to all the other options. So they get to college, and then after all that is done, the college changes the rules, right? They mandate the primary series. They mandate the booster. So these kids are really captive, and I think that it's unethical. It's a high risk. It's a risk mandate. And then it also, on a more subtle, esoteric level, it's training young people that it is okay to become leaders who then do this, who don't respect bodily autonomy, who put in place a policy that is not necessary and very questionable from a scientific standpoint. And I find that disturbing. And I also, it's trouble all through that policy.
Yeah, that's a really
good point.
And one other thing,
even if you said, okay, there really aren't adverse events, which is not true, the fact that these are new products, that we can, by definition, we do not have long-term safety data for these products. We don't. They're brand new. There is some evidence to suggest that there could be an impact on reproductive health because there's been widespread menstrual disruption. There was a study that came out of Israel that showed a depression in sperm count and motility in a sperm donor population when you looked at vaccinated versus unvaccinated. Now, people say, oh, it's transitory, it resolves. I would say we don't know that yet. So at the very least, we should pump the brakes on this and give these people a choice, give young people a choice, and not force a novel product on them wholesale that they don't even need.
Yeah, good point. And back to you. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I'd like to make two comments, you know, historically about the FDA approval process. You know, the FDA approval process, you know, the FDA's mission, if you look at their website, is to protect the public from drugs and medical devices, and really that's their goal. And historically, there was really two principles of the FDA approval process, and that is to never basically test products or, you know, experimental products on children and pregnant women. Those were untouchable in the history of the FDA approval process. Yet in the COVID shots, we were fine releasing it without testing, without thorough testing of pregnant people and children. The other thing that I want to say about the FDA approval process is, historically, to approve a drug or an intervention, the FDA and the drug companies had to prove something was safe and effective. In the COVID shots, it's ironically almost opposite. The people that are injured, for example, we have to prove that the shots are not safe and ineffective. So the whole principle of how things got approved, even though it's approved under emergency authorization, is really a novel. This is the largest clinical trial in the world's history, which should raise people's concerns.
And let me just add to that your point about, you know, testing on children and pregnant women. Keep in mind that every college mandating a booster right now is by definition mandating the bivalent booster, right? Because as of last September, the original series, you know, the original shots, the monovalent shots, they're not being given as boosters anymore. So if you're a first year at Dartmouth right now, or at any school that mandates a booster, and you had not been boosted before, you had to take the bivalent booster. Now, just consider this. That shot was not approved based on any human data, and specifically was not tested in this age group. So again, it's a mandate to a young person of a product that has those characteristics and, again, isn't a needed product. So that should be very concerning.
Yeah. I think at this point, it's a really good segue into the event that's coming up in Dartmouth. Do you want to talk about that?
Michael?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So I think I want to, you know, go back to when I sent the open letter to Dartmouth. I didn't get a response at that point. I gave it a few more weeks, and then I decided I'm going to reach out to some other alumni of the college. I sent the letter to some fraternity brothers of mine, and Christopher Drysback responded, you know, and we spoke briefly and recognized that we were both seeing things very, very much eye to eye on these issues. But more important than that, you know, what struck him the most about the letter was this concept of having an open discussion at the college about these mandates and talking about the risk reward benefits. And we decided then and there we were gonna plan this with the college, ideally, so we could have a more open, uncensored dialogue. We decided to reach out, and by the way, I should mention, Chris Drysback, he himself was vaccine injured in March 2021, taking the Pfizer.
This is your fraternity friend.
That's right, yeah.
Friend.
Out of everybody that I sent, it wasn't a big list. He was the only one that responded at the time. And it also was the case that he himself had been vaccine injured, and he was a full-time practicing attorney who could no longer practice law.
Gosh.
To the extent that he was after his injuries. And in fact, even to this day, and I think the expectation is that he will never fully recover. The good news is he ended up working with REACT19 as their legal affairs director, and that's ultimately how we were introduced to Joel and the team there. So, you know, it's a blessing in disguise that he responded in the way he did. And what we decided was we wanted to have this debate at the college. We invited the college to work with us and at a minimum provide representation. To this day, they have not chosen to send representatives. We hope that they will.
Do they?
And so,
do they say why? It seems they'd really want to take part in this. I can't imagine why they would not.
Well, I don't. I mean, you know, if you talk to any one of the panelists, I think they would all say, "What arguments could they possibly have, and do they really want to make that a public argument?" I think they were willing to communicate with me prior to the open letter going out, and I think that was viewed as probably too much for them. When we made several attempts to have their participation, unfortunately we didn't get a real response about that.
I'll just make one brief comment about the college mindset. Based on my own experience doing advocacy work nationally in this arena, I and many, many other stakeholders have written many, many letters to mandating colleges. Either they respond or they tell you why they're doing what they're doing, but never has any college engaged real discussion on it. Maybe colleges used to do that, but that doesn't happen now. They just tell you, you know, this is our policy, and there isn't really a back and forth. So that, I think it's more of a mindset, but go on, Michael.
Sure. So the actual event will be held on Wednesday, April 26th. It's two phases. One is a roundtable discussion, which will start at 3:30 at the Hanover Inn, which is, for those of you who don't know, set at the south side of the Dartmouth Green. So it's right on the edge of the campus, and it's college-owned. That roundtable discussion will last about 2 hours. We'll have it live-streamed, and we've made it available to Dartmouth ID holders, as well as the public, on a first-come, first-served basis for free based on donors that we had step up for this event. We had sold out the public tickets, I believe, as of today, for this call. We're going to open up another 10. So anybody who does want to join for the afternoon session can. But again, you'll have to go to the website and sign up for those tickets, the website being react19.org/D19. And then in the evening, what we wanted to do was have a dinner fundraising event where the proceeds would go toward React 19 for the benefit of the COVID-19 vaccine injured. And that will be keynote speakers. We'll have Aaron Siri, who's an attorney and who's been very involved in fighting mandates, in helping to ensure that the FDA could not keep, FDA and Pfizer could not keep certain data from the public for 75 years. That was what they were trying to achieve. And he was able to get that overturned and have them start providing those documents much, much sooner. So we're very excited to have Aaron Suri join us. And, you know, the roundtable discussion, we will have some terrific panelists. These are all key players who've been outspoken against mandates, whether it be for colleges or for workplace. We'll have Martin Koldorf, who's a professor on leave at Harvard Medical School. He was a co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration.
Could you briefly describe what the Great Barrington Declaration is? I know a lot of people are not familiar with it.
Yeah, this was a letter that was made public, where you had a few of the original co-authors and then a number of other medical practitioners, nurses, sign on to it. And the key aspect of it was, we don't have to lock everything down. Let's focus on making sure that the most vulnerable in the population have access to treatments, whether that be vaccination or otherwise. But I think they were against the idea of widespread, wide-scale forced inoculation, lockdowns, you know, having children leave schools and learn from home. And the reason why it's become so important is because it was very early on. I don't remember exactly when that was first published, but it was signed on ultimately by thousands and thousands of doctors from all over the world. And that was viewed as one of the only ways that doctors could really express their concern, because as I mentioned earlier, the media really wasn't covering it at all. And anything, you know, and that whole discussion was censored. So this was the way of getting that idea out there.
It was in October of 2020, and the three authors were Dr. Martin Koldorf, who will be on our panel, who then was a professor of medicine at Harvard. He's a biostatistician and epidemiologist. I mean, he is a revered scientist. Dr. Sunetra Gupta, who's a professor at Oxford, and Jay Bhattacharya, Dr. Bhattacharya, who is a professor at Stanford University Medical School. Those are the three highly esteemed professionals who authored the declaration, who were smeared as being fringe. So I just wanted to jump in and give that the gravitas it deserved.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding.
I think Michael is talking more about the panel.
The additional panelists who will be there on April 26th.
Yeah, we'll have Dr. Aseem Malhotra. He's a UK cardiologist. He'll be joining us remotely. You know, what I find really interesting about his background is, at one point, he actually got on TV in the UK and was trying to combat vaccine hesitancy around these vaccines.
Really?
And so, in a way, he was really promoting them. I think, you know, at the time, it was really more available to the elderly and the more vulnerable, which I think is where he really felt that, you know, it made the most sense. But you know, subsequent to that, and it was several months later, through either whistleblowers or people that had contacted him, and then eventually his father actually died of a cardiac arrest. And he knew his father's history very well. Ultimately, he felt that the vaccine was one of the causes, if not the main cause. And he ended up going back and reviewing the clinical trial data from Pfizer. He published a peer-reviewed article where he actually found that if you just looked at the actual results from that trial, you had a higher likelihood of being injured or having a serious adverse event and death than in the vaccinated group than the placebo group.
That's amazing.
I think 6 months out. You know, the 95% efficacy, that number is based on a relative amount of people. So if you look at the full trial data, and I don't have all the numbers for you, but there, I think it was somewhere around 10,000 in each group, and it was only 100 or so who actually got COVID, and, you know, a fewer number within the vaccinated group. And that's where that 95% number comes from. But the absolute risk of getting COVID in those trials was extremely low. And that was never discussed. So he, I think, did a very good job of laying that out. And he's been very vocal ever since to really put an end to these shots to help raise awareness. So he'll be joining us remotely. We have Dr. Joel Walzkog, who obviously is on this call and has already provided his background.
Oh, that's great.
And then we have some interesting other panelists. So we have Dr. Sandy Ryder, who's a family physician. He's from the Vermont area and also a founding member of Physicians for Informed Consent.
Yeah.
And we have attorney, or I should say law professor, Todd Zwicky, from George Mason University. His story is also very interesting in that he got COVID, he had the infection, and he was mandated to get the vaccine, and he ended up suing his university to, against that because of natural immunity that he acquired in getting the infection. And then lastly, we have Brooke Jackson, who is a very vocal whistleblower who was involved in the phase 3 clinical trials of Pfizer. Pfizer farmed out those trials to an organization that she worked for. She had oversight at one of the clinical trials, and she saw a number of things that she ultimately blew the whistle on I think really call into question the foundation of those studies. Joel mentioned some of the people that were injured. We'll talk about just the unblinding of certain people in the study, the issues that she found. And she ultimately sued on behalf of the government in a False Claims Act against Pfizer. That case was recently, now I guess they're going to be appealing the decision, and they're looking to ultimately get discovery and get reciprocity for, you know, what they viewed were real issues during those trials.
Gosh, I just need to, we're at the top of the hour, do a station ID. You're listening to WMRW 94.5 FM, and this is the 4-H show. I am speaking to Michael Koss, a Dartmouth College alumni who received his MBA from NYU Langone Health Program, Dr. Joel Walzkog, an MD and surgeon who's the co-founder of REACT19, and Joni McGarry, who's the co-founder of No College Mandates, and she's a mother of a student currently attending Dartmouth College. And we're right now discussing the event that's going to be happening on April 26th at Dartmouth. Well, the Hanover Inn is part of Dartmouth, is that correct?
It's Dartmouth-owned, yes.
Okay. And it will be at the Hanover Inn, and you're hoping to get some Dartmouth staff to participate, it sounds like, but without any luck yet. But the panel sounds fascinating, and especially you do have an attorney which can answer maybe a couple of the legal questions that I had. I'm still wondering how these mandates are legal, and it would be interesting to talk to an attorney.
Well, we will definitely have some question and answer. And Todd Zwicky is really well-versed on this and explains things in a really great way. One thing I wanted to add on the panel, where we've just announced our moderator, and that will be Kim Witzak. And if you've not heard of her, she is a leading global drug safety advocate who is a consumer representative on the FDA Psychopharmacologic Drug Advisory Committee.
So
she has an incredible depth of knowledge about FDA approval process, about drug safety, which is her her mission, to make sure that consumers really are made aware of the approval process and the risks and benefits of every drug. And she herself has an interesting story. And also has been impacted by drug safety. Her husband was prescribed Zoloft off-label, and he took his life. And some of the symptoms he had prior to that were things that the pharmaceutical company knew of but had not made public. So she ended up suing Pfizer and won.
Wow.
And so she's very conversant in legal matters surrounding pharmaceutical products. Wow. And she just brings with her a wealth of curiosity and knowledge about this arena. And so we're thrilled to have her. She could be a panelist as well. She's just, she's really great on all these issues.
That's great. I also was wondering, maybe Joel, just to talk a little bit more about REACT 19, what it is, what its focus is, and what you do.
Yeah, thank you very much. I mean, first of all, you know, as I stated, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. We're very grassroots. We're very science-based. We're a non-political organization. We're really an advocacy organization for those that are injured by COVID shots. You know, we're not just about telling our sad stories. And what I say is that we're about taking our negative reactions and turning it into positive action. You know, we are about giving the injured hope and support. And the way we do that, our really mission is really threefold. We give, we try to give the injured financial, physical, and emotional support. So financially, we give grants out to injured people or people, Americans injured by the COVID shots. We give grants out for up to $10,000 for uncovered medical expenses. Physically, we are very involved in education. We hold weekly webinars for both providers as well as for injured people. We are starting up a research grant program, try to stimulate national or even international research into the COVID shot injuries. We've also developed care networks, both a medical provider as well as a mental health provider network for the injured, really, to be able to receive care from what we call as vaccine-injured-friendly providers. And those are providers that recognize the injury as well as have some knowledge about available diagnostics and treatments. And lastly, in the emotional realm, We have well over 21,000 people in social media-based support groups. Unfortunately, at the end of 2022, we had to start up a new bereavement group for parents of, unfortunately, dead children. And then lastly, we have what's called an advocacy network. So we have a team of nurses and social workers across the country that can be assigned to newly diagnosed or newly injured people that need more one-on-one help. And that can be anywhere from finding a provider, finding pharmacies, financial issues, housing issues, et cetera. So that's really what REACT 19 is about. We are really here to help and support the injured.
Oh, that's fabulous. It's great work. It sounds like a great organization. I just know I've talked to a few people who are vaccine injured and really desperate to try and find help.
Yeah, it's really tough, okay? So I don't think people understand when you're injured, you're really, and I can't stress this enough. I mean, the number one thing I felt, and I'm in healthcare, the number one thing I felt in the year of 2021 is I was abandoned. And you just feel like you're on an island with no one to help. And really getting, you know, we're doing and react what I wish our providers, our health organizations, our federal agencies should be doing. But because we are really abandoned, we're doing it ourselves. And one of the things we're trying to do in our strategic plan for 2023 is open our first ever medical clinic here in the United States. We're going to open up our own clinic only to treat COVID-19 vaccine injury.
Oh my gosh.
I want to do that partially because I think it's needed, but I also think it will be very symbolic that we couldn't get care, so we had to do it ourselves.
Yeah.
So we hope that that clinic will be open sometime this year. We've partnered with a medical group that will provide the medical care called Global COVID Summit. That's Richard Urso and Kat Lindley's group. I hope it'll be down in Fort Worth, Texas, but part of obviously what we need is funding. So
yeah.
That's why our financial needs are great. You know, we take 100% of the donations, say, from this Dartmouth event, and we put 100% of the donations right into our care fund, which is the grant program to the injured. Again, our board is 100% volunteer. We are all about trying to give these people hope and support. And as I hope you can see, I mean, what I've tried to communicate is, you know, we want to have a dialogue with people. And this mandate, this anti-mandate event at Dartmouth is exciting because, you know, we should be able to have, you know, a dialogue. You know, science is, there's few things in science that are absolute. Encourage, you know, the administration and the people of Dartmouth to show up because science is dialogue. And we should be able to have a discussion. I'm not here to say I know every, you know, I try to be very science-based, and the things I've said today are fact-based and you know, are specific, you know, I use specific numbers, but I want to have a discussion. And frankly, the people at Dartmouth and the administration should show up because we should be able to have a dialogue because science should be a dialogue.
Yeah.
Michael, I think I want to also add to that. This is the problem with censorship. If doctors had the freedom through this entire time to have those sorts of conversations without feeling the risk of their license or ostracism, whatever the case may be, there would be a lot more doctors who are aware or would have been looking for these sorts of medical issues of their own patients post-vaccination. And the fact that most doctors, I think, even today, are not recognizing that these are real potential harms. They're probably misdiagnosing a lot of these issues. And, you know, I've seen that on a personal level, where if you're not looking at the vaccine as a potential cause of harm, you may be completely missing the boat. I'd love to hear what Joel says about that, but I've heard enough doctors speak about this. And to me, it seems like a really large problem that we still have today that we have to get through.
Yeah.
I can speak a little to that. I mean, I will tell you that I know that well over 90% of us are gaslit by our providers, meaning the providers either don't recognize their injuries or choose not to recognize them or just can't recognize them. So we are often underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed. And unfortunately, you know, again, I do understand that providers are very hesitant and worried about the medical boards reviewing them or penalizing them. But again, I want to challenge providers because they're obligated to first do no harm. They took an oath to first do no harm and really to act as, you know, as good stewards for their patients. But you know, I also want to tell you that, you know, they need more direction from their employers, their healthcare organizations, and they also need better direction from the FDA. I've had numerous meetings directly with Peter Marks. Peter Marks is the head of biologics at the FDA. And while sometimes they'll say, well, we didn't see a safety signal, say, for neurological complications, which are probably the most common adverse event, I begged him literally. I said, even if you don't see safety signals, can you at least communicate trends that you're seeing? And the answer is no, they don't, and they haven't. So we need better communication all the way from the FDA, which is the regulatory agency, all the way to the health organization, to the provider, to really be looking out for these injuries and recognizing and treating them. But it's not happening.
And may I just jump in and say one thing about the FDA, which is, you know, probably not known to many people. And I think it was the early 90s, the FDA changed how they did business a little bit in that they started to take user fees from pharmaceutical companies. And the goal of that was to speed through approval, right? Because there was a backlog of approvals. I think a lot of generics were waiting to be approved at that time. So they thought, well, we'll let pharmaceutical companies pay a fee to us when they submit their drugs. So the unintended consequence of this is that now I think in excess of 50% of the FDA's budget, and I would urge you to check that, but it is a very large percentage of the FDA budget is now paid by pharmaceutical companies in the form of user fees. And I'll just leave that on its face.
Yeah, how does that fit in with conflict of interest?
Right, and also there's sort of a revolving door, as happens, you know, sort of naturally in many industries and academic institutions. People have an expertise in an area, and they go from one organization to the other, and then you have friends and buddies, and, you know, it's very difficult to regulate the people who are paying your salary. So, you know, so that's an inherent issue, and I think a lot of physicians are not aware that this is an issue. So when they get information about a drug, they really just don't know the genesis of that information. And then that also brings another point, which is just generally institutions of higher learning are also having, you know, there is a conflict issue there because they are recipients of millions and millions of dollars from the federal government in forms of grants, research money, all sorts of things like that. And, you know, it doesn't, like, it's like 60% of that money is from the Department of Health and Human Services across the board. If you look at the numbers, it's all publicly available. So if you look at just the Ivy League schools, all of whom, except for Columbia, who recently dropped, all of whom mandate these products, I think they get about $3.5 billion a year in federal money. And this has nothing to do with COVID. It's just, you know, this research project, education projects, et cetera. And these are schools with enormous endowments, and yet they still get this money. And so it just creates the appearance of, you know, I think we need to question, who are they working for? Like the doctors, are they working for their patient, or are they working for the system? So those questions need to be raised. And then some colleges own intellectual property for these shots, and specifically Dartmouth is joint holder of the patent with the NIH and Scripps Research.
Really?
That creates, yes. You've heard recently that the FDA just got a $400 million payment from Moderna for that technology. And what it is it was discovered, the technology creates a way for your body, it makes the spike protein of any coronavirus, or just not just COVID-19, but coronavirus. It creates the most antibody eliciting form in the body. So it's technology that's very, very useful in a vaccine. And in fact, it's used across many of the COVID vaccines, if not all of them. And so there is a revenue stream going to the NIH, to Dartmouth, and also to Scripps Research for that. And then the University of Pennsylvania, who also mandates these products, they took in, I think, nearly $1 billion in royalties from technology associated with these vaccines, which is a different technology. Now, to be fair, you know, the student body population is a drop in the bucket. It's not like Dartmouth is mandating these because they're making money off of their students on this in any appreciable degree. However, if you're benefiting financially from a product, one should be asking the question, even in a vacuum, you know, is this an ethical thing to do? And so you just have a lot of capture, a lot of relationships that I think over time can really blur objectivity.
Yeah. Well, we have a few minutes left, and maybe you would just like to, I'd just like to mention before we end the event, the time, the date, and how to access getting signed on, and the benefit of it's a benefit for REACT 19 that Joel just described, and it sounds like a fabulous organization. And if Joni, one of you just want to talk a little bit about that.
Thank you. It's Wednesday, April 26th. The roundtable discussion, which will feature the panelists and our moderator to have this open discussion, will be at 3:30 at the Hanover Inn. There are a limited number of general admission seats available to the public, and there is a block of seats reserved for Dartmouth-affiliated people for the discussion. After that, there is a dinner to benefit REACT 19. Tickets to that are $300. All proceeds after dinner expenses go to REACT 19 directly, and that will begin at 7 o'clock, and there are still tickets available for that. And if you want to go, I would encourage you to get tickets very soon. You can find them at react19.org/DART, with a capital D, D-A-R-T, C, capital C, 19, and that is the website. And if for some reason you're sold out, just email us at this email address, info@openlettertodartmouth.com, and we'll put you on a wait list.
Okay, and the keynote speaker at the dinner is Aaron Seary, correct?
The keynote speaker at the dinner is Aaron Seary, and he is a fantastic speaker, and he doesn't speak all that often at events like this, so I would encourage anyone to go. You're going to learn something, whatever your views on this are.
Okay, anything else before we close that you guys would like to mention or say?
I would like to clarify that if you do sign up for the dinner, it does include a seat for the round table. And we did have a number of public seats, but subsequently we were sold out. So really today we're opening that portion up for your viewers or listeners. Mm-hmm. And we hope you'll join us.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank all three of you for your time. Michael Koss, Dr. Joel Wascog, and Joni McGarry, for taking the time to come on the show. Great information. I hope people can make it to that Dartmouth event. I know you'll see me there. I'll get to meet you in person.
I look forward to it. Thanks for having us, Gary, and thank you for all your viewers. I mean, your listeners.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a great Friday, and I will see you next week with the 4-H show. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you so much.